one of the great things about this time of year is we get the chance, with a bit more time on our hands, to talk to interesting people in sport. And this man has got a fantastic story to tell, and hopefully we can get it out in the next half hour or so. I first crossed paths with him, geez, I don't know, the late 80s maybe?
Actually, yeah, you were the captain of Melbourne under 19s.
There you go. Yeah, that is the voice of Ben Crowe, who's doesn't need an introduction. Wisp. He's on the front foot, jumped straight in.
Straight on the front foot. But also he was part of the very early SEN too. The Business of Sport, he did a regular spot with Hutto and Dermot in the afternoons. Is that right?
That's correct, Brian? Yes. Yeah. 4 till 6, I think it was. Prime time SEN there. Yeah, things have changed a little bit, Timbo, in terms of the studios here.
It's kicked on a bit. Hutchy got a hold of it. And, those days when I first met you, you were with Nike, and that's where I guess this whole – it is quite an amazing journey because you're now caught up with some of the biggest sports names in this country here but also globally, and we want to try and unpack and just go through all that. But Nike was where it all started for you.
Yeah, very much. And Nike's competitive advantage was their emotional connection with the athletes and their – focus on storytelling, and whether it was, you know, Live Strong or Just Do It or Air Jordan, it was always the emotional connection of the athletes and the story. That was their Nike's competitive advantage against the Germans, as we called them, you know, Adidas and Puma and so forth. And yeah, that's kind of where I guess I first fell in love. I studied storytelling and philosophy at university and always had a love for it, and then just understanding what made athletes tick, I guess. But yeah, Nike was very much where I guess I cut my teeth.
And that was your great, and you and that, and the whole Nike crew of Georgie Lawler, who's still going around all the time. From our experience, well, my experience is that you got so involved with the athletes who you were sponsoring. It wasn't just, yeah, here's your boots and nick off. You got immersed into their lives and you become friends and mates. And I guess that sort of attitude has carried you, you know, to where we're going to take it. But was that always something that you just came naturally enough to you? I mean, it ends up being Agassi, and it was Bo Jackson back in the day who I was fascinated with, and you would tell great stories. But was that always there?
I think so, yeah. My dad died when I was pretty young. I think I've always been searching for that, you know, sense of purpose and humanity myself, I guess. And I've been, you know, surrounded by beautiful family and friends. But yeah, it's always been a genuine interest. Both my brothers are doctors, and I think I just must have been a wannabe who ended up working with athletes at Nike, and it's probably just kind of grown from there.
Has the athlete changed over time? The style of athlete?
Yeah, great question, Tim. I think I don't think the athlete's changed per se. I think the environment around the athlete has changed phenomenally in the last, say, 10 years. And the thing about the sports industry, like the entertainment industry, media, film, and you guys have been part of both industries, really, there's just so many distractions that can take you away from the, you know, the authentic version of who you are. And if you start to focus on those distractions, and whether it's media or social media or, you know, parents, sponsors, fear, you know, ego, identity, it's a really quirky industry. And if you get caught up in the persona of who you are, to the detriment of the person who you are, what Gary was kind of referenced to, you're in a world of pain. So if Dusty Martin walks down the street, or Ash Barty walks down the street here, and she gets recognised as, you know, world champion, it's the same thing as Mickey Mouse walking down the street. Yeah, we don't know her. We know the persona of her. So it's really important for Ash or Dusty or anyone who works in the industry to separate their identity, the persona, from who they are. And if they get caught up in that, they're in a world of pain. So once you realise it's not real, therefore, it's not personal, right? So if you're an athlete and you get criticised in the media or social media, it's really important to separate. It's not actually real. Therefore, it's not personal, right? If in the AFL, 17 out of 18 people are going to hate you by virtue of, you know, you play for a specific team. So just understanding the rules of engagement is probably more pronounced than ever. And there's probably just all these distractions that we're getting caught up in.
As a result of that, are there greater insecurities associated with athletes now than they once were, or with regard to that, are they pretty similar?
As far as insecurities leading into, I guess, anxieties, if you're focused on something you can't control but wanting to control it, like your ego, or like the result of a tennis match or a football match, you will be distracted. And by definition, that will cause anxiety or stress or worry or pressure. So it's really about focusing your attention back on the best version of you, who you really are, and what you can control, and let go of all these distractions that typically sabotage performances, which is either, you know, ego and identity off the field or your focus of attention on the field.
So this is the space that you play in now, and we'll explore that further. take me back to the early days, though. If ever, I would have given footy away to take Ben's job, Wisp, because his job was when the tennis players come, just to go and entertain and give stuff away to them, basically, and then make them feel comfortable and then travel in the world. So talk us through some of those people. Yeah, what were they like when Agassi, Sampras, and you know all the big Nike athletes were arriving in town and your job was to sort of half look after them, or fully look after them?
Well, obviously I had nothing in common with them, Gaz. I was 25 years old.
I know. It's just unbelievable. I couldn't get my head around what you were doing.
So I would just literally ask them questions about themselves. And it kind of dawned on me that for a multi-billion-dollar industry, the rules were pretty embryonic in terms of how an athlete showed up or how they survived the fishbowl, which is the sports industry. You might be lucky that you're Pat Rafter and you've got, you know, 12 brothers and sisters and beautiful family like Ash. Or you might be unlucky, you know, that you don't kind of have that support around you as well. And it kind of dawned on me that it's more luck than design how athletes turned out. And I used to just ask them if they'd had their time again, what kind of things they'd do differently in a press conference or a sponsorship decision or whatever it was. And it blew me away how consistent the mistakes that athletes were making, from Cathy Freeman to Andre Agassi or Roger Federer. And
what mistakes are you talking about?
Oh, just in terms of getting caught up in, you know, making decisions for the wrong reasons.
Right.
You know, the whole management industry is predicated on, you know, short-term, shark-infested, sales-orientated commission.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of predicated on saying yes to everything rather than, okay, what's right for me as a person, more so than what's me as a brand. So there was just, the rules of engagement, if you like, are pretty embryonic, and that kind of fascinated me. And we did a life plan for Tiger Woods in 1996, and that fascinated me as well.
We did a what?
A life plan, effectively.
You
a
business, and Nike?
A business plan.
This is you and Nike, yeah.
Yeah, there was kind of three of us who'd kind of funded the...
Right.
I was running Asia Pacific at the time. And it was kind of just that process of treating an individual like a business or a brand just absolutely fascinated me. And after I left Nike, I was kind of just stayed mentoring more as a hobby and as a friend, if you like, for, you know, the Andre Agassi's and Clarko. And
I don't know, Steffi, I don't know who else was there. But who of all of them had their shit together best?
Andre is probably my favourite story in terms of as an example of someone who, you know, everything in his life was a lie. He hated tennis, you know, his relationship with his dad ostracised New York, his relationship, he's probably his first marriage to Brooke, even his hair was a lie, you know, he was kind of wearing a wig. He just happened to be a great tennis player. So much so that he won 3 Grand Slams and, you know, obviously made a lot of money, but it's very hard to live that life. And his life started to spiral out of control. And this is all well written in his book, Open.
Great book too.
Yeah, it's the number one sports book on the planet, actually. It sold 8-1 at the time.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It's the best sport. If you haven't read it, it is the best
sport. Put it out there because we love giving recommendations.
It is the best sports book I've ever read.
Yeah. If you've read Shoe Dog, is Phil Knight's most recent.
I've read that too. I preferred the Agassi one. I couldn't believe the Agassi recollection of thoughts and the detail that he went into. He must be a detailed person because he was able to recall stuff that most people probably would have just discarded or forgotten.
Yeah, and he was probably the first athlete who really embraced vulnerability as a strength. He said himself he's got more to lose than gain from writing that book, but he said if you really want to show up in the world, you really want to connect with the world, you've got to show up real, raw, imperfect, vulnerable Andre Agassi. Mm. And that's what he did, right? He took off that mask and took off that armour. But through that, you know, he blew out to 141 in the world. And, you know, he remembers standing in the hotel room of his hotel and looked down the street below and it looked like people, you know, had their shit together. And he'd never felt that way. And through that process developed his sense of purpose, which was around education. And he subsequently set up a $1 billion business, you know, with Michelle Obama and set up 64 charter schools across North America. But then also found his love of tennis, you know, created a team. He said, "We, not I," which, you know, Ash Barty does a lot now as well. And he found his love. He found love. He found Steffi Graf and had 2 beautiful kids. And he got back to number one in the world and won another 4 Grand Slams. So it was an example of that, you know, that hero's journey, that transformation. Andre's probably one of my, you know, more favourite stories.
You mentioned vulnerability, and we know that you work with Richmond you've worked with Trent Cotchin. You've got a friendship with Trent Cotchin and then Damien Hardwick as well. And they've spoken often about vulnerability. So did that whole discussion of vulnerability start with you and them? Is that where it came from?
I was working with Peggy O'Neill at the time and couldn't run the leadership program through another business that I was doing at the time, Unscripted, but I agreed to mentor Damien and Trent. All the credit goes to those guys and Peggy for the transformation of Richmond, especially around purpose mindset. And, authenticity, vulnerability, connection, storytelling, these principles of something that they've really kind of embraced and celebrated. Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, Tim, especially an alpha male, yes, stoic Aussie.
Yes, but they are talking about then. We are finding that everybody in the footy world has started to talk.
It's a movement.
It has become a movement.
It really has. And, I mean, the two most watched videos on the planet today is Simon Sinek's Start With Why, which is around purpose and purpose mindset, and Brené Brown's Power of Vulnerability. And those two videos alone have had almost a billion views, right? So this isn't, you know, more recent fads. The whole world is craving that ability to take off that mask and armor and just let ourselves be seen. You
know? I love that, and that change that's come about with Trent Cotchin, not only the way that he presents himself, but the way that he played. I mean, there was a change, a really huge change in the way that he played. I mean, he is the most selfless player, leader. He's a great leader. You know, at that time he was being questioned about his leadership. You know, they're all before that premiership year. Is he still the right bloke to be the captain? Should Jack Revolt be the captain? But he just completely took over that team. And he, for me, from the outside, and you know from the inside, but it seems to be that he drives all that as the leader of that particular playing group.
Yeah, very much. Him and Dimmer, definitely. We're so hard on ourselves as a human race, and we've got this unconscious negative bias telling us that, you know, getting caught up in perfection myth or feeling like we're not good enough or, you know, we don't deserve to be captain or not loved enough, successful enough. And you can give yourself permission to be imperfect, you know, but also unconditionally worthy. Mm. If you can hold those two thoughts together, you can take off that mask, take off that armor, give yourself permission to be worthy of love, connection, belonging, taking your team on a journey, you know. And yeah, the Trent story was beautiful, from, you know, unofficially voted the worst captain in the AFL to officially, by his peers, voted the best captain in the AFL.
And most respected too right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's all credit to Trent. He's literally found his authenticity. And from that point of view, he can, you know, show up in the world.
Is it going to turn again? Like, this is footy cyclical, sports cyclical. Yeah, right now it's on point to go, I want to be vulnerable. It's, you know, all the things you talk about. Be prepared to, you know, be imperfect and speak about it and, you know, take the armour off, all that sort of stuff. Can it go too far is my question.
Oh, there's got to be boundaries, guys. Yeah, if you're just doing it for the sake of, you know, of attention, for instance, or craving recognition. You're doing
or it's
it
not authentic.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing it for the wrong intention. But, yeah, I get asked that question a lot. Is this the most recent fad, if you like, in sport? I mean, purpose mindset has been around for centuries, if you like. You know, Mark Twain said, you know, 150 years ago, the two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. We've just lost perspective, not just the sports industry, but, you know, we're the most addicted, medicated, in debt, obese adult generation in the history of the world. So we've effectively lost perspective on some levels. Sports, just, I guess, a very small element of that. But I guess all across the world, we've caught up in this craving of recognition, caring what people are thinking about us and saying about us, as opposed to what I think of myself. And
so the social media, it all buys into this as well. It's a negative reinforcement.
Yeah, there's all these macro trends that are causing this. You know, it's global warming, GFC, terrorism, you know, this obsession with identity, breakdown of religion, breakdown of family, this obsession with identity that's fueling the tattoo revolution worldwide. So there's all these macro fears that, yeah, storytelling used to be a trained profession. You know, you'd go to university, do a course in graphic design or communications or advertising. And if you did those courses, you'd learn empathy, you'd learn intention, and you'd learn objective. Now, 15 years ago, when this technology was unleashed on the planet called social media, it effectively democratized storytelling for the whole planet, right? And now there's 3 billion social journalists. Yeah. But we were never taught what to say as a human race. So what we did was we started focusing on ourself, self, self, self. Yeah. We became self-absorbed. We became self-obsessed. We're comparing ourselves. We created this thing called a selfie.
Yep.
And as a consequence of that, if you're focused on yourself, you're suffering, yeah? You don't call it that. You call it stress or anxiety or worry, because we're hardwired for connection to others as humans. It's kind of, you know, we're neurobiologically hardwired for connection to others, and that gives purpose and meaning to our lives. So it's kind of, it's getting out of that obsession with self, and that's where vulnerability and connection and authenticity kind of come in.
Sometimes we, because this is an area that we love talking about, Tim.
We do, and we talk about it often.
Yeah, and for this is like, for us, Nirvana, we could talk about it for an hour, but the feedback's incredible, Ben, and I think it's, get Ben on every day. I could listen all day. I was going to get in the shower a half hour ago, but I can't. You'd be noticing this not at just the elite sport level. You'd be noticing this across the board. I know you're talking tonight out at Doncaster. If you want to hear Ben talk tonight, it's a charity dinner. Don't care, community service. I don't know whether you can still go out, but you know, on the basis of this feedback, people can't get
There's
enough
a great
of this
appetite
stuff.
For this conversation.
I think we've just lost perspective, if to say it really simple. I mean, the work we're doing is really just helping athletes with their mindset on the field, but their perspective off it. And they might have achieved, but they're often not fulfilled. You know, they've been extrinsically motivated, money, fame, status, titles, and that's all okay. But if they're not intrinsically motivated, things that really light them up internally, they'll never find that kind of unconditional self-worth, you know, looking outside, looking externally. You've got to kind of find that from within. But it takes a lot of – that's where vulnerability is important, because you've got to lean into that risk and uncertainty and emotional exposure with finding out who you are. And most of us don't want to do that.
No.
Because we're worried what we might find. We don't – you know, we're not worthy. We're not loved enough. So it's easier to put on that mask and that armour for self-preservation purposes, because I don't want you to know that I'm not perfect, so you'll never actually see the real me.
Do you get frustrated at the wider media, us included, that, you know, we can only assess on whatever we see, and we make judgment calls and we talk about people, but we don't – I mean, I'm learning more in this half an hour than I have for a long, long time, but do you then go, well, you're making calls on people, it's affecting them, but they – is it so? Is it us that are doing that, or writing articles about people, whatever it is, or is it the ability for people to absorb that and then park it if they need, or take on whatever it is?
Yeah, the issue for me is not media, and neither is it social media. It's the education and the understanding of what is real and what is not real, right? In particular,
you say that a lot. What's real and what's not real?
In terms of our identity and our ego, and we're getting caught up in that and believing that's real, right? And including, I mean, it's called a game. Sport's called a game. Yeah. Game theory is based on the principles of compete, have fun, and play, right? So play games. It's the entertainment economy based on storytelling. It's not actually real. It's just an industry, and it's predicated on creating expectations and hype. And that's good. Once you understand the rules of engagement, what's real from what's not real, then you can get back and focus your attention on things you can control.
Hey, Ben, you told a great story before about a young girl that you'd spoken to a class at a school. Can you just retell that story about that particular girl?
We spoke to about 500 girls at Loretto Mandeville about 6 months ago, and I won't kind of reveal any names, but I got a phone call when I was in Wimbledon walking down at Ashes second round match with her coach, Craig Tizer, and had a beautiful message left on my phone from the vice principal about a mum who'd been in her office crying about her daughter who had been on medication and been in and out of hospital for depression, and I just wanted to teach them two things. One was to be able to call crap on perfectionism and be able to say, you know, I am enough. And secondly, just draw down on a series of words that they could draw down on the best version of them if they were getting nervous before a race or nervous before a test. And she went home that day and she said to her mum, she said, Mum, do you know that I'm enough? And the mum was kind of distracted cooking. He said, what do you mean? She goes, did you know that I'm enough? And he goes, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, there's this guy at school today talking about Ash Barty and Steph Gilmore and stuff, and I just realised that I've been comparing myself against Millie and Annie and Lucy and so forth, and I don't want to do that anymore. It doesn't make me feel good anyway, and I've just realised almost this aha that I'm enough, right? And anyway, she's now back at school. She's getting involved in other sports activities. She's off medication and so forth, and it kind of – that gave me a sense of excitement, I guess, that these principles aren't just for athletes. They can be kind of taught
everyone.
To the whole planet, yeah.
Hey, Ben – Ben Crow is the man that we are speaking to, and I just need to say this because that's all people want to know is, who is this and how can I hear him speak? What's your time like this morning? We're good enough, mates. I know you've got other stuff. If we pushed you to stay late, would that be possible or not?
Yeah, that's fine. I'm emotionally connected to SEN, as you know.
All right, so this is great for us. So we'll shuffle a few things out, and we might throw some lines open as well at some stage because people want
to – I think it'd be great to do that.
Yeah, and people want to talk about this. We haven't even got into Ash Barty, and we want to hear about, you know, the transformation with Ash going from someone that gave tennis away and thought that cricket might be an option to coming back and being the number one tennis player in the world, and your role in all of that as well. It'd be fascinating. And a couple of videos that you mentioned before, people would love you to mention those again. What were those two most watched videos you spoke about?
Simon Sinek.
Spelt?
S-I-N-E-K. And the videos start with Y. These are both on TED.com.
Right.
And the other one is Brené Brown's The Power of Vulnerability. And Simon's kind of been a bit of the godfather around purpose mindset. And Brené has been kind of the godmother of vulnerability around the world, yeah.
Would you be we're nearly at the 17. You won't be able to answer this in 30 seconds, but have you had anything to do with Nick Kyrgios?
No, I caught up with Nick very briefly in in Wimbledon. But no, I haven't worked with him per se. I've just started working with another tennis player, Grigor Dimitrov, through through Andre Agassi, who's a Bulgarian tennis player who's just a beautiful human being.
And Andre's coaching him?
Andre's coaching him, yeah.
And you, he got you involved with him?
Yeah, after Wimbledon. So, yeah, he went to the US Open and, yeah, made the beat Roger Federer and made the semi-finals, which is, yeah, a beautiful story.
We're like the rest of you, it would appear. We're just picking Ben's brain here.
Chewing his ear, we are.
Every opportunity we can possibly get. Okay, let's just don't ring yet. We'll let you know when the lines are open for Ben. We've got a few more things we want to rip through here. Ash Barty, it is one of the great stories. And again, as people who talk about sport, Tim and I sit here and go, how is it that we can have someone that's just so normal, so self-effacing, so humble, is now the number one tennis player in the world? It sort of goes against the stereotype of where they need to be. Do you want to tell us as much as you're prepared to talk about Ash and your role with her?
Yeah, I think she's probably one of the greatest role models on the planet today in terms of someone who, you know, obviously lost her way, found passion for the sport, walked away from it, got caught up in all the, you know, the pressure and the expectations of others, the white noise, as she calls it now.
Is that what happened, is it, with Ash Barty, when she lost her way?
Yeah, I think she did. Yeah, she...
She lost sense of who she was.
I think she got caught up in all the expectation and pressure that comes with, you know, she's 15 years old, she wins Junior Wimbledon, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's all this expectation, if you like, or pressure that comes from whether it's media or the organisations or sponsors and so forth. And I think she just lost her passion for it, I guess, and then took a break. But her hand-eye coordination is quite phenomenal. And thankfully, she got into playing cricket, and then through her best friend Casey Delacroix, got back into tennis, and then came in kind of version two. Yeah. If you like.
And when did you enter?
After Wimbledon last year, she had a bit of a setback.
That's when she said had a little breakdown sort of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she, just to join the dots here, so for her, she started doing some training at Richmond. Through that, she met Trent Cotchin. Trent Cotchin had already started working with you. Then Trent Cotchin said to Ash Barty that she should get in contact with you, and that's sort of how it unfolded, yes?
Yep, pretty much, yeah. I'd already had a couple of chats with Craig Tizer, her brilliant coach, and also Nikki, her manager, who's a good friend as well. So there was a few different connections, but, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Ash rang Cotch the next day, and then, yeah, she came down to Melbourne, and yeah, we spent a very emotional week together.
A week,
yeah. Well, on and off, yeah. And then, yeah, the rest is history.
So she obviously did. She recognize it straight away in the message that you were delivering that was going to be right for her.
Yes, yeah. She's been. I mean, she's very lucky. She's got the most beautiful family around her in terms of values and what's right versus what's wrong. So she's already. She intrinsically gets it, absolutely. But again, like most athletes, just probably just got distracted from all these things without real. And as I mentioned, we're just so hard on ourselves. Yeah. And Ash was probably...
So you're not a tennis coach. So where do you start with somebody like Ash Barty?
The process is really, there's really only two questions to answer. The first one is, who am I? You know, fundamentally, who am I really? Right. And then once you can answer that, the second question is, what do I want? But in order to answer the first question, you've got to understand that our life story is not our life. It's just our story, yeah? And we're the author of it. So you've got the ability to write the ending, but you've also got the ability to go back, and these crucible moments that are kind of holding us back, you know, they're laced with meanings. And you go back to also these memories where you tell yourself, I'm not good enough, good looking enough, loved enough, successful enough, and reframe or forgive or let go or accept.
You're saying you should reframe.
Absolutely, yeah. So, as again, go back to those stories and say yourself, give yourself permission to be enough. But also, as I mentioned, separate. Playing tennis is what Ash does. It's not who she is. It doesn't define the depth of her. And now she knows who she is.
Yeah.
So she has this beautiful perspective, which also enables her to laugh more and just have more fun, you know, and understand what her goals are and separate goals from expectations. Most athletes don't set goals because they think they're an expectation, so they don't want to put them out there and think, I'm even more of a loser. But if you can separate goals from expectations, as Ash has done, you put those goals out in the universe and you go after them.
Yeah.
You know, no guarantees, no expectations that you'll actually achieve those goals, but I guess that's called living.
Yeah.
And she's understood that. And to her credit, you know, put herself out there with those goals. It's been extraordinary. I think she's surprised all of us, but probably most importantly herself in terms of what she's capable of when she gives herself permission to go after that.
It's a piece, and Cotchin is the other one when you see it. Like, the notion of players running out to play a game as important as a grand final laughing, you know, is, to me, when I first saw that, it's just contrary to everything that... But then you see Ash Barty play, and she laughs, she has fun, she loses when she shouldn't, and you think that's the end of the world, but she's not. So this context that you talk about is just, it seems to be the really consistent theme across all these stories.
Yeah, well, and you guys are probably world-class at this very principle, right, is that it's imperfections that connect humans the most. Mm. So if you think about your relationship with your family or your best mates, right, it's the nuances. It's the little things, it's the idiosyncrasies, it's the in-jokes, it's the self-deprecating humour, you know, it's the stories, it's the laughter, it's the tears. That's the gold. We call these things imperfections, but that's what actually connects humans. Once you realise that, you can take off that mask and just have fun, right? So humour, absolutely, as humans, right, we're at our best when we're laughing and we're spontaneous and having fun. So this whole thing about have to be serious and so it'd be statistic-based and it's got to be, you know, winning at all costs and so forth, that's the classic alpha stoic Aussie male that's causing so much of these issues.
See, that's a breaking down of that. Is what is happening here in front of our eyes. And I still find it the most fascinating thing.
Yeah, and is there potential for this? Do you think this is going to be something that becomes part of world sport? Because I think it's just like the tip of the iceberg.
I hope so, Tim. I really do. You know, the AFLPA and AFL are saying mental health the number one priority. Australian Cricketers Association has just said the same thing. They're saying the same thing all over the world. In terms of athletes getting distracted by the demon of expectation or focusing on things they can't control but wanting to control them, which is the definition of anxiety, right? The definition of stress. Thing about that, it's not actually real. Pressure only exists if you're focusing on something you can't control. Once you can identify with that, let it go and focus your attention back on what you can control and the best version of you, life is beautiful. It's free. It's easy. But we're just so distracted today on so many different levels.
Critical to this working, though, and I think this is the fascination for me for Richmond, is that you start talking about Peggy O'Neill. Okay, so Peggy is the chairman or the president. So she embraces what you're talking about. Okay, and then it trickles down. Then you've got the captain who embraces, and then more importantly, you've got the coach that embraces this. And he started talking about his vulnerabilities as well publicly. I didn't know that this is where it started at the time, but then it's sort of for somebody like us that have been around footy and completely taught the opposite in terms of the way that we came through the game, to hear somebody talk about it, really, it's jarring.
Yeah, and you're right. It's counterintuitive to how we think. Certainly males, certainly stoic alpha Aussie males. You know, what do you mean celebrate imperfection? What do you mean embrace vulnerability? What do you mean storytelling? What do you mean have fun, take the piss, right? These are actually counterintuitive to what we think, you know, what we think about being serious and putting on that mask and kind of going after it. But it's kind of I'm hoping it's the unlocking of just some, you know, a perspective shift that this whole thing is a game. It's not real, you know. And once you understand the rules of engagement of game theory or the entertainment economy, you can separate what's real from what is real.
I don't even know how to describe him now. Life coach, mentor, been with Nike, been a business owner as well, but he's just talking common sense, basically, and we got the opportunity to ask a few questions along the way. Can I just ask this, Crowey? So we're talking elite sport, but the stories that resonate most are when you tell the story about the schoolgirl and, you know, who you spoke to amongst 500. If there's mums and dads and even going to school and young people listening, is there anything... any advice that you could give to a parent, for instance, that may be looking at the kids and wondering if they're, you know, they're struggling a little bit, or how do they reconnect? Or, and I don't want you to preach. We're not preaching. We're just throwing it out there, and if it helps, it helps. If it doesn't, and if you've got it all under control, then good on you.
But the greatest thing a parent can say to their kids is also the greatest thing a coach can say to their athletes. Six words. I love to watch you play. You know that time when a kid gets in the car at the end of a game of footy or netball or whatever and they're driving home? They did a beautiful study with NBA basketballers and college athletes across America to talk about, you know, their memories of childhood sport, the things that they hated the most and the things they loved the most. And overwhelming response was they remember, you know, the ugly parent syndrome. Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you kick it that way? In terms of that transference of unfulfilled desires from the parent down to the kid. What they do remember is when their parent just literally said to them, I love to watch you play. It says so much about the sense of humility and humanity and just that unconditional love that you have because the kid's cringing, right? It's just that's all he wants to hear.
It's not I love you watch. It's not I love watching you kick five goals or take 10 marks or win 6-5, 6-2. I just love the involvement.
Yeah, yeah. I love to watch you play.
Joel's from Richmond. G'day, Joel.
G'day, lads. Ben, just wondering what your advice is to perfectionists.
Yeah, perfectionism is when you're focused on someone else. Or you're caring what others think of you and you're kind of craving that recognition. Perfection is not real. Right? It doesn't exist. It's an external manifestation. It's actually not real. Don't get me wrong. You can be in search of excellence. You can be in search of self-improvement. You can achieve those things. They are real. But you've got to let go of perfectionism. And that's what I mean by the antidote to the perfection myth is to celebrate imperfection. You know, because it's imperfections that connect humans the most. You know, that the little things, the nuances, the idiosyncrasies, the self-deprecating humour, the stuff that Gary and Tim do every day, right? It's imperfections that connect humans. And once we understand that, we get back to those little things that are really, really important, you can let go of perfectionism and take off that perfection mask or armour that you've got and kind of just let yourself be seen vulnerably seen, you know, really seen.
Good on you, Joel. Lindsay's from Somerville. Go, Lindsay.
Morning, Gary, Tim. And this is great stuff. You've got me thinking on many levels. But I'm curious to know what it is about Chris Fagan. Right from the first time he went into that club, his first press conference, I've had confidence, contentment. My attitude towards my football club is totally different purely because of that guy. What is it about him?
Well, he's had brilliant people around him. Mm. Clarko is arguably the greatest coach of the modern era. And the reason is his sense of humility and humanity and perspective. But Chris clearly is a beautiful person in and of himself and understands, getting the best out of humans first and then professional athletes second.
Great call. How long have you been working with Clarko, or how long have you been associated with Clarko?
More as a friend, yeah. Tim. A long time, but more just as a hobby or as a friend. In more recent years, yeah, a bit more pronounced and a bit more professionally, and certainly in the last probably five or six years.
We've talked about experienced coaches in Damien Hardwick, who was around for a while before he showed his vulnerability and talked about that. What about somebody like Matthew Nix, who just takes over as the Adelaide Crows coach for the first time, stepping in, coaching his first team as an AFL coach? Would you advise him to show his vulnerabilities like a Damien Hardwick showed his group his vulnerabilities from day one?
Yeah, absolutely. What's happening is when we go into an environment, a new condition, in his case a new coach, we tell ourselves a certain story that we're either enough or we're not enough. Unfortunately, what's happening all over the world is we're creating these vertical relationships where we're putting ourselves below others, right? Which at its extreme is an inferiority complex, or we put ourselves above others, right? Which at its extreme is a superiority complex, but it comes from the same place that I'm not enough, right? The solution to that is create horizontal relationships. I am enough. I'm different, you know, but I am worthy. I'm a new coach. I don't have all the answers. I'm imperfect. I'm full of struggle and I can't do this on my own, but I am unconditionally worthy of being the coach and taking you guys on a journey. And that's really the opportunity and the mindset that he wants to kind of create, rather than pretending he has to have...
I've got all the answers.
...have the answers in day one, yeah.
This is a message come through. Thanks for answering every question I've asked myself in a long time of soul-searching. What a ripping interview. That's from Justin. Brett's up in Brisbane. G'day, Brett.
G'day, boys. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Ben, I just wanted a comment on what you said a minute ago about... saying to your kid when they're playing, how much you love watching them play. And I grew up, as I'm sure Gary and Tim did, with a different generation where your parents weren't giving you a lot of credit for what you're doing. And I'd make a point of saying to my young fella, I love watching you play, I love watching you train, and just the pride in their face. Yeah, it's just brilliant.
Good on you, mate. Statement. Good on you, Brett. I think it has resonated everywhere. So we would love to have him as a regular, and he's welcome here anytime. But I fear that it was going to be a bit hard to track down given the work that he's doing. We're trying to narrow down. Can you just tell the story about the two sorts of people that you see in the world? Because this might, I think this is just so relevant and may even sum up a bit of what you've talked about for the last hour.
Yeah, no worries. You could almost simplify the world in terms of two human beings. Those who see.
And just before you go, yeah. If you're sitting in the car or you're listening to this, as Crowe describes this, I want you to think about which sort of person you are, one or the other, and then you can apply whatever it is Ben's saying.
Yeah, great call. There's literally two types of people on the planet today, those who view vulnerability as a strength and those who view it as a weakness. And if you view vulnerability as a weakness, typically three things happen. You're closed, you're closed-minded, you're defensive on the back foot, you know, feeling like you're being attacked. You're not very compassionate, first for yourself, because you think you have to be this perfect specimen, right? So you put on that mask and that armour for self-preservation purposes, because I don't want you to know that I'm not perfect. And then you won't be compassionate for others, because you've got to be compassionate for yourself first. And then you won't create that connection, which as humans we're hardwired for.
Which I would think is, it was certainly me. That was me when I was 25.
Majority of
100% me. Yeah.
But the opposite is also true. If you view vulnerability as a strength and you lean into the risk and the uncertainty, the emotional exposure to put yourself out there, the opposite three things happen. You're more open, you're more open-minded or curious, creative, childlike, innovative, whatever word you want to use. You're incredibly compassionate, first for yourself, and that's probably the number one issue on the planet at the moment, Gaz. We have to be kinder and gentler to ourselves first. We've got to cut ourselves some slack, give ourselves a break, have a little bit more self-acceptance, self-worth, self-love, whatever you want to call it. We just got to be kinder to ourselves first, and then we can be compassionate to others, and then we can create the most beautiful connection that you're looking for.
And just quickly, because we are running out of time, how do we teach that within our children? Is that because of how we display ourselves in front of our children, or is it more than that?
Yeah, very much. Parents are the greatest role models on the planet for kids, in the way that coaches are for athletes as well. Making sure that they don't attach their self-worth to whether they win or lose a race, whatever score they got, what they look like. There's no external validation that will ever determine their self-worth. They're already unconditionally worthy. And the only difference between people who have wholehearted, fulfilled lives and those who don't is those who do believe they're worthy of it. They believe they're enough. Yeah. It's like it's a fundamental belief.
Can we get you back on as a regular in some way, or are you just so busy now traveling the world that that's almost impossible?
Love to, Tim. Love to.
When you're back in the country, because we know that you're traveling again soon and you'll be with Grigor and with Ash Barty over the journey. I mean, honestly, I don't know if we do any good on this program, but I know we have today, Tim, having Crowey on. Be enough. These are things I've written down. Just be enough. Be happy and be enough. Tell your kids you love to watch them play. That's enough, and that tends to work. And this is the one I get overwhelmingly from you. Stop allowing others to judge you and work out whether you're good enough. You do that yourself. Crowey, your body star. We thank you for coming in, mate.
Well done.
And
loved it.
We will talk again soon.
Thanks, guys.